Welcome to History's Hotties, Episode 2, The Sometimes Forgotten But Influential Women in American History. This podcast is a discussion of women who have helped shape American history, and I am your host, Krista. So before we get into Episode 2, which is the continuation of the story that we began in Episode 1 about Catherine Beecher, who I believe is a pioneer educator in our nation, I want to talk a little bit again about the purpose of this podcast. Say a couple things that I didn't really say the first time. First off, I have to attribute the name of the podcast to my friends Psycho and Red. You know who you are. They helped me come up with a name and thus a theme for the podcast. My reason for using the term hotties is certainly not because all of the women that we will talk about here are hotties, so to speak, and it certainly is not to demean women, because that is definitely not the purpose of this podcast. It is kind of a play on the irony of the fact that all throughout history, women have been considered, their purpose was to have children, to be the bride, to stand on the arm of a man, and sometimes their purpose in history, their real contributions to history were recognized, and sometimes they weren't. So I thought maybe to play on that a little bit and to maybe laugh a little bit at, you know, where we were and what we've come to today can, might make history a little more interesting. I'm not going to talk a lot about the women that we all know, the women that we read about in textbooks, the women that were historically written about in textbooks even before the movement in the 1960s and 70s to really explore more about the contributions of women in history. Your Abigail Adams, your Martha Washington, your Dolly Madisons, even your Deborah Sampson, who some of you probably know, was a woman who actually dressed as a man and fought during the Revolutionary War. I more than likely am going to be talking about some women that you may not know as much about, and even some prototypes of women. I said last time, a type of woman like the plantation mistress or the mammy type, or maybe even the yeoman farmer's wife during the Civil War, and how she was feeling. You know, her plantation wasn't at risk, and her husband was off at war for, you know, a cause that really may not have made any sense to her. We're going to talk about different types of women and how they worked, how they lived, and how they really influenced who we are today. Anyway, I will now give you again my disclaimer, which I do plan on reading pretty much every week, just because I want people to understand that I do not profess to be an expert on any topic I present. I do have a bachelor's degree in history, and I will do my best to present well-researched history, but if I do make a mistake or fail to touch on a fact that you, the listener, think is important, please contact me at the email address that I will provide at the end of the program. History is not finite. It is a living and breathing study. I can only report on what I have studied and interpreted to be the most accurate version of the past. I will inject a little bit of my opinion, because history wouldn't be any fun to me if I couldn't have an opinion. So with that, I will continue on with the story of our first history's hottie, Catherine Beecher. When we left off with Catherine last time, her fiancé had died in a shipwreck, and her not very congenial father, the first thing he asked her was, how are you going to use this for good? And Catherine was no fool. She was aware that she had to have a way to support herself. She actually became the provider for four of her younger siblings that her father had with his second wife. Her brother Edward was putting himself through university with his own education, and a lot of burdens fell on Catherine's shoulders. Funny enough, she couldn't vote. She couldn't make an independent decision about what she wanted to do. She had to have her father's permission. But the responsibility of feeding everybody fell on her shoulders. So it's, you know, it's to me really an ironic thing that, you know, she was to be responsible, but yet she really didn't have a whole lot of rights to do what she wanted to do. So anyway, so now we've gotten to the point where Catherine has opened up a school in Hartford. She's communicating with all these people in Hartford who are like the social creme de la creme, inviting their daughters to her school. Their daughters are attending her school. She's communicating with them. She is trying to influence the town and raising funds for her school by asking these men who are leaders in the community to support her efforts. So really, she's communicating directly with these men in politics, which women were really not supposed to enter the political field. They were supposed to be at home. They were supposed to be out of the political limelight. But because she was teaching girls, it was okay. Which goes back to the idea that Catherine had, that women could enter the world, but they needed to do so in an appropriate, I'm using my quote fingers, appropriate female role in society. So at this point, Catherine begins to publish essays. Like I said before, Catherine's sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, was not the only writer in the family, not the only prolific or famous writer in the family. And one of Catherine's particular essays outlined her theories of women as teachers. She believed that they not only were a moral boost to society, but even equally as important to society as men. She argued in her essay, suggesting respective improvements in education, that teachers were more important in society than a doctor or a lawyer. That came from, by the way, Schoolhouse Pioneers, which is an article that you can find on pbs.org, great website to find information about all sorts of pioneer educators in the United States. But to suggest that women were equally as important in society as men, I mean, that was big stuff at the time. And according to Catherine Sklar, the pushback that Catherine got for this were from people who really feared that their daughters would, instead of being educated enough to make great wives, they would be over-educated. That was a bad thing at the time, apparently. That with over-education, they would be vain, and that with all this extra knowledge, they would not want to get married. They would not want to have children, that they would not want to become wives because they would have all this education. Women really, really needed to have babies at the time. Science was in its infancy. Children died often. People had big families and oftentimes still lost quite a few children. We were getting better. People were losing less children than they had, say, during the Revolutionary period, not, you know, 70 years before. But, you know, people still did lose children, and that was a big deal. You know, girls needed to go have a family, get married. You know, their male family members did not want to have to support them forever. And so this fear that seems funny to us now, in an age where actually more women than men go to college, that women would be overeducated and that would ruin their lives, was a real fear. Catherine, however, was determined to train the young women in her schools in the, quote, social, religious, and moral principles, along with academic education, and then to send these women out into the world to begin other schools that could do the same thing. Catherine said that her goal was to actually begin a national movement that would and I'm going to quote Catherine here, let the leading females of this country become refined, pious, and active, and the salt is scattered through the land to purify and save. Unquote. I would say that's a pretty lofty goal, but that was her goal, and now this has become her stated goal, not just a goal that she's working on as she's building this school, but actually something that she started to write about and publish. Beyond that, there were some other social factors that were kind of simmering under the surface of in society that were setting up this sort of perfect storm to begin the rapid growth of females in the teaching profession. According to Sklar, Catherine Beecher actually wanted teaching not only to be open to women, but to be a female profession. She wanted women to dominate the profession. The cult of domesticity in the middle class, with these women that were unemployed, created the perfect available workforce. Public schools were becoming more prevalent as states were expanding. They were opening up, you know, schools funded by the state. And then there's this huge expansion west. So all of these three things together were merging with the idea that women could morally guide children in and out of the home. And so Catherine put together, you know, that the classroom was the perfect place for that. Those in sort of society in the East were really concerned about Catherine's unorthodox doctrines in her elements of mental and moral philosophy. She published that anonymously, by the way, so nobody knew that it was Catherine Beecher who published this at the time. But people were concerned about these principles, these society elites who were really scared of this middle class, as we talked about in the beginning of the last podcast. So when Lyman Beecher headed west, Catherine decided that with the fear of these people in society that she was running into in the East, that she would just go west with him. So she's started these writings. She's got these ideas. The middle class is accepting them. She sees that there's an available workforce. There are public schools to fill with teachers. But the social elite of the East really weren't going to accept it right then. So she said, fine, I'll move west. So their trek actually took them to Cincinnati, which Catherine loved. It was a raw city that had, you know, building and growth, but yet it also had, you know, things for the refined taste. It had theaters and it had salons for learning and libraries and all these other things. So she liked it. But she did have to change her tactics a little bit when she went there. And, of course, her first obvious step was to begin a new female seminary like the one in Hartford, which was still running, by the way. She left one of her female students in charge. The communal unity of New England really wasn't there in Cincinnati. There was kind of a mixed population that all had different ideas about issues, such as slavery, and the city leaders were determined to keep those issues quiet. They really didn't like the idea that there was all this social nonconformity in the town, because that really did not exist a lot in the towns of the Northeast. Catherine was able to enter the socially elite circles, and Lyman Beecher was now a member of the Western Literary Institute and College of Professional Teachers, which helped Catherine. Now, she could not belong as a woman, but she was able to attend and have influence through her father. So now we've got this scenario where Catherine has moved west. Society is a little more open. You have ideas. There's still some where you can have more open exchange of ideas. There is some pushback from the conservative city leaders, but you don't have a completely closed society that's really hard to get into and change like it would be in the East. Catherine was able, of course, to open that school in the East, but that did not necessarily mean that she was really going to effect change there and create this female workforce that she wanted. So at this point, Catherine began to reach out to the women she had trained in Hartford to come and begin teaching in the West. She was going to fulfill this dream of creating a generation of these morally guided teachers. Like I said, the local leaders were not always open to it. She faced challenges from local publications that were not really ready to embrace the idea of Western education as a way for women to civilize their rough culture. They really wanted to kind of lift up the common man, the hardworking man, not really ready for that, you know, civilization. So Catherine sought out a new publication called the American Lyceum, which was actually based in New York and called An Essay on the Education of Female Teachers. And that was subsequently in Cincinnati as well. So we've got this kind of weird mix of the Open Society in Cincinnati that fought her a little bit, the Closed Society of New England, which was willing to look at education reform, but they really, in the East, wanted the education reform for the people in the West, and the West didn't necessarily think they needed it yet. So Catherine's working in between these two societies and figuring out how she's going to mesh the two. So instead of encouraging the people of the West to want to emulate this Eastern society, Catherine decided to begin to speak on the fears of the middle class, of the poor immigrants' ability to destroy American democracy, and also played on the cost of Western expansion, arguing that 90,000 teachers were needed because the men moving West were far more likely to seek employment with greater pay than the new towns of the West could offer. So her plan was to have privately funded female schools to train teachers under her plan as moral and academic educators, have some of the women go on to train more teachers, and then send other students out to train the children of the West to open up, you know, rural schools, small town schools. She wanted the initial venture to be privately funded by business leaders in the West and then expanded to a system that would be run through a national school system. So this is Catherine's dream that she has now developed. The citizens of Cincinnati were insulted by Catherine's description of the rough West, and she fell short of her initial goal for fundraising for this female seminary that she was going to start by $15,000. At this point, some of Catherine's writings, like The Moral Instructor for Schools and Families and containing lessons on the duties of life arranged for study and recitation, also designed as a reading book for school. Now, that's a long title of the period, stemmed from the pushback she got from these social elites in Cincinnati because of her belief that even the rich should help develop thrifty habits in everyone, including themselves, in case they lost their fortunes. Needless to say, the wealthy people in Cincinnati were not really keen on the fact that Catherine thought that they ought to go sort of back to this strict moral upbringing because they could lose their fortune, because nobody wants to consider the fact that they might lose their fortune. So she is just making everybody mad all around now. This was a new American middle class ideal, you know, saving for a rainy day, and it was really abhorrent to those who were seeking to emulate this British social system, which included a distinct difference in the level of education between those who were born into privilege and those who were not. So if you start to try to educate a privileged young person that you better really watch out and be thrifty with your money and learn how to sew and to cook and to do work in case you actually have to do physical labor one day, these socially elites really believed that they would lose the social status that they had attained, and what they believed was the respect from the poorer classes. I know this explanation of the challenges that Catherine faced is kind of a long explanation, so I apologize for that, but so Catherine's quest is not going well in Cincinnati, so she begins to travel back and forth from east to west and east to west, looking for women to come to this school in the West that she started so they could be hired by locals. Catherine was really hoping that a lot of the schools that were being built would be looking for teachers. She built a reputation in the East as a go-between for the two societies. Her second school was not doing well financially, so Catherine began to write more to support that school. And finally, she wrote a text on the domestic economy that kind of refers back to the thrift that I was talking about before, that earned enough money for her to live on while she pursued this goal of the national system of female-led education. But her treatise on the domestic economy, not only made her this money, it became her most famous writing. Which is kind of interesting that of all the things that she wrote, of all the controversial topics that she covered, this treatise on the domestic economy became really her most famous writing, and you can still look it up on the internet today. You can read it, and there's nothing outrageous or outlandish in it. It's really funny enough, sort of good advice if you delve into it for, a well-run household, except for all of the really, really rigid rules on female behavior. But as far as just running your household well, I mean, it was really good advice at the time. People did not have a lot of extra money. They certainly didn't have the room to waste like we Americans do today. And so, she was, people, especially in the middle class, really liked what she had to say. And she really wrote it for the new sort of servantless American household. She addressed thrift, cleanliness, cooking, child rearing, first aid. Which was really new to the American household, and as well as pretty much any other topic that was relevant in the life of a middle-class wife in the 19th century. So, in the mid-1940s, Catherine finally found a benefactor in Cincinnati who supported her ideas for family, and she began an organization headed by Calvin Stowe, brother-in-law. Really, this is a statement of her acute awareness of a woman's inability to gain widespread support on her own by attempting this strategy of, having this organization that was headed by a man that she was actually in charge of. And her organization mirrored the idea of kind of the temperance movement in the schoolhouse. Rather than continuing her attempts to break in these upper crusts of society, Catherine really began to espouse the belief that all women could teach, not just women in wealthy Eastern families, not just women and even in middle class families. She said that now mill workers were being exploited and not improved by their working and living situations. Like women in the Lowell Mills, if you read the writings of the men who ran the Lowell Mills, they truly believed that they were bettering the lives of these women who worked in their mills. And even though, these girls worked in terrible conditions and were, told how to live, told what they could do with their off time. They had very, rigid rules and had to live in these boarding houses, and would come back and forth between their farms and the city where the Lowell Mill was. They believed that they were helping these women. Well, Catherine said, no, you're not. You're exploiting these women. And you know what? I think even though they're lower class women, they're from working families, that they can be educated and teach. And that was a really strange idea at the time. She asked women of all classes to donate their efforts to education and encouraged upper class girls to be useful through employment rather than waste their time living the normal life of leisure available to those young women with money. Catherine worked hard to venerate the teaching profession as the profession of a woman, and she embarked on a really big speaking tour, continued to sell the treatise that we talked about before, and led other people really honestly to believe that Calvin Stowe and the Board of Gentlemen had control over the funds of this foundation that she had now created, which really was helpful and does show that she was quick-witted. I mean, her father knew from the beginning she was quick-witted, which was why he, basically turned over the raising of his younger children to her. And she was no dummy. She knew what she needed to do to make her organization successful. By the way, you'll have to excuse the barking in the background. That is our beagle, Annabelle, who apparently sees a moth or something outside. And I have tried to keep her outside and to stop from jingling and barking at things, but it's just not working. So you'll have to excuse Annabelle in the background. Anyway, so back to Catherine. So she's pulling a salary from this benevolence group that she started and starts to hit up churches and other women's organizations in the East. She became so successful that the former governor of Vermont, took over the position that Calvin Stowe had held. And once William Slade joined the cause, the communities in the West were far more willing to get on board with Catherine's plan. Young women began to move by the dozens to the West for a month of training under Catherine's curriculum that she had set up for training teachers and placed into schools throughout the West. They covered the states from Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, which had just become a state, by the way, Iowa had, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And these young women were teachers and Sunday school leaders. They taught in the classroom during the week. They were active in these community churches during the weekend, and they became part of these communities. Catherine and William Slade initially intended the teachers should pay them back for the cost of their training. Not many of them did. They really didn't make enough money to pay Catherine back for the, or the foundation back for the cost of their training and to still live on their own. But some of them did donate a little bit to support the cause of bringing in more teachers. By now, these eastern states really understood that women teachers were more cost-effective, as were the ha as had been the female mill workers. Why, the Lowell Mill started bringing in, unmarried girls in the first place. They were just more effective workers. They didn't have to support a family on their own. They weren't expected to support a family on their own like a man was. And so they were willing to work for less. So Catherine was able to utilize this bias against women to advance her agenda, assuring her male detractors that this was only a temporary place for women to support themselves until, I love the way Jo March put this in Little Women, succumbing to a matrimonial fate. So, some of Catherine's famous friends by this time, she had made some pretty famous friends that we may talk about in a later podcast. Debated with Catherine Beecher about certain subjects, like Angelina and Sarah Grimke. They were social activists, abolitionists, and women's suffrage supporters. Catherine Beecher was not a suffrage supporter. She believed that women should receive equal treatment in society because they were agents of moral change, while the Grimke sisters fought for equal rights because they believed women were just fellow humans and should be treated as such. But interestingly enough, at the time, Catherine was better able to sort of force a moral and sort of temporal change because she knew what limits she could push. She knew that there was no way that women were going to get fully equal rights at the time. So she her intention was to make the changes she could change within the system that existed. Angelina and Sarah Grimke were often really disparaged by the men around them and ignored simply because these men believed they pushed too hard, which, of course, we know their tenets were exactly right. They were right to fight like they did for equal treatment, for suffrage, for all of these things, but they got a lot of pushback and were pretty vilified in the media. So at the end of our story, William Slade, our former governor of Vermont, moved temporarily to Cincinnati, kind of tried to break into society, realized, you know, as we talked about earlier, that there had been some resistance to these education reforms. He didn't want to kind of put himself out with the greatest of the social elites in Cincinnati. So he moved on to Cleveland and turned the organization that he and Catherine were running together into the National Board of Popular Education. Catherine, at this point, went to a retreat where she rested for a while before she returned to writing and traveling to promote women's education through her new association. She now separated herself from William Slade. Her new association was called the American Women's Educational Association. Catherine promoted accepting women into universities and higher education for all and continued to be involved in the building of schools for women. Ultimately, the Civil War, except for a really brief stint, again, as a principal at her own Hartford Female Seminary, which Catherine had founded originally. The Civil War kept Catherine from re-entering public life. After the Civil War, she really was just too far advanced in age to travel around like she had been. And the nation, by the time it really stabilized sufficiently to allow a woman to speak and travel, it had moved beyond the need for her to continue to, you know, generate female seminaries for teachers. By this time, women really had largely taken over the teaching profession. So, Catherine, in conclusion, Catherine was not a true feminist like we would define feminist today, but she certainly worked within the limitations of her time to advance the cause of women. Like I said before, she didn't support suffrage for all women, but only those who were economically independent. The arguments of women like the Grimke sisters fell on deaf ears. Catherine was keenly aware that small steps were necessary to make changes in the 19th century United States and took advantage of every opening offered her to promote the idea that women really could contribute to society. So we go back to the beginning of our last of episode one, and to our 75% statistic. So 75% of all teachers now were women. How much of this was due to Catherine Beecher's efforts, and how much of it was an inevitable shift in mandatory public education? No one will really ever know. However, I am pretty certain that Catherine Beecher can take some credit or criticism for this move, depending on your opinion. You know, some people say it's not a good thing that teaching is a female-dominated profession because it keeps salaries low. Others say that, you know, it was a great way for women to break out into the working world. Some historians will tell you that if women hadn't broken into teaching, that it may have been the early 20th century with the arrival of the female office clerk and the growth of more mills and the need for female factory workers that would have kept women out of the workforce at all, except for pretty much domestic service, and may even if women already weren't teaching when the need for office clerks came along, you know, women still may not have been the obvious choice, which, you know, that was a great way for women to break into working society. So all I know is that Catherine Beecher affected the future of women in the United States with little historical fanfare. We may read a small excerpt about her in school while discussing the cult of domesticity, but I believe she deserves much more consideration. So I name her the first of our history's hotties. If you would like to learn more about Catherine, I recommend Catherine Kish Sklar's Catherine Beecher, A Study in American Domesticity, and PBS.org, where you can find an entire section on Schoolhouse Pioneers. If you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please contact me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. There is no apostrophe in the email address. I know that today's episode has been kind of a long episode. My intention is for the episodes to not really be any longer than about 25 minutes. So this one was really long. I felt like there was a lot of material that I wanted to finish up and cover, and I appreciate any of you out there who are listening, and I hope to be back soon with episode 3. I still have not completely decided who I'm going to talk about in episode 3, but I'm working on it, and so hopefully we'll be ready soon. So for now, it's good to talk to you all, and I hope to hear from some of you.